Welcome to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, hosted by Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements of Drab to Fab Landscaping. Garden Talk aims to introduce new ideas to help solve problems and keep you up to date on the latest development in the nursery and landscape industry. For a podcast of today's program and others, visit walteranderson.com and click on the podcast tab. Now, here's your host.
Good morning, San Diego. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements. We will be here for the next hour talking to you about all kinds of stuff going on in your yard and garden. If you have a question for us, would like to comment on the show, or have a suggestion for a topic or guest you would like to hear about, you can email us at gardentalkradio@walteranderson.com or follow us on the Walter Anderson Nursery main Facebook page. Good morning, guys.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I hope everybody still has all 10 of their fingers after the 4th of July.
Almost blasted a finger.
Fortunately, I never got close to that one myself. So
nor I.
But you're listening to Garden Talk here, and we have a special guest today. Chuck McClung is going to join us. Actually, he has joined us. And Chuck not only used to work here at the nursery at one time, he's also a local author. He's published a couple of books. One of them, the first one was on how orchids rebloom. And the second one, which came out just last summer, was Strawberries Are Not a Fruit. So, Chuck, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Ken. Thanks for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to come in and talk
great,
to us.
Great.
We've got some interesting stuff to talk about. Before we came on the air, you were saying that first of all, to start off with, you're one of the few, if not the only person that I know in this business that has not only a degree, but an advanced degree in a botanical background. You have a master's degree in botany, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Which is unusual. I mean, we in this business, when you find people that have a true formal education, it's usually in horticulture. And horticulture and botany are two completely different.
Very separate.
Very, very separate disciplines. And I happen to know that because I've only taken one plant related class in my entire life, a formal class, and that I took an undergraduate class in botany at San Diego State way back in the day. And it is two completely different disciplines. And typically in this business, in the nursery business, you'll find some people that have degrees in horticulture, but most of the people basically just got into it kind of as a on the side,
as a passion, I think, for a lot of people.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I grew up in the business. My dad grew up in the business. My grandfather was a farmer, so we really never had any formal education. But where did you get your degree from? It was up north, was it not?
Yeah, my master's degree is from Washington State University, and my undergraduate's from the University of Illinois at Chicago.
Oh, okay.
And I had worked for Oregon State University doing research, the University of Montana. And it was during those years that I realized that I liked working with plants and people a lot more than I liked working with plants and politicians. That's how I got out of it.
I could see that.
Yeah.
So. I could see that. Your first book that you wrote, How Orchids Rebloom, what prompted you to write that?
Yeah, good question. So for many years, I lived in the Pacific Northwest after I got out of college, and I decided, well, I really like working with people. So I worked at a very large independent garden center, a lot like Walter Anderson Nursery, that was began by the owner's father, very similar. And we're doing a class one time in the fall called How to Winter Over Your Geraniums, Fuchsias, and Begonia Baskets, something like that.
Yeah, something that we have to deal with here on a pretty regular basis.
Well, that's why I moved here, so we don't have to do that kind of thing. But to start the class, I'd ask people, you know, where'd you hear about it? And I asked this woman in the front row, and she raised her hand and said, well, I drove from like 38 miles away. And what I did is I put into the computer, you know, how do I overwinter my fuchsia basket? And this class came up, and this was in the late 90s. Mm-hmm. And like in that moment, like light bulbs and dollar signs went off in my head. And I thought, why don't we just call our classes what people want to know? And coming up was the class on orchids. And I said, why don't we just call it How Orchids Rebloom? And like 80 people showed up. And after having done that class for several years, people said, well, you should write a book about it, but write it the way you say it. Don't write it the way it's in books. So that was kind of the prompting for that. And it took many years. It was just something I worked on slowly, probably for about 7-8 years mm-hmm. to finish that. So that's where it came from, because of one class. But that's probably the class I've done the most over the last 20 years is how orchids rebloom.
And this covers a wide variety of orchids. There's a lot of different orchids are actually one. That's one of the largest plant families
yeah.
in the world.
Right.
So there's epiphytic orchids, there's terrestrial orchids.
Right.
And having sat through his class many times, because he's taught it here multiple times. The 10 different groups, right, of orchids that you speak to in the book.
Yeah. And the fourth chapter I call the top 10 groups of orchids. And I find that like at nurseries, box stores and that, you can take any orchid that's for sale and put it into one of 10 groups. Now, if you go to the orchid show in Balboa Park, that's totally different. Mm-hmm. But when you come in here to Walter Anderson Nursery, any orchid you see is going to be in one of these 10 groups. And yeah, they're all different because orchids as a group are as diverse as plants. There are orchids that live in the Arctic Circle. There's a species of orchid that lives entirely underground in Australia. There are orchids that live everywhere and they're just different. Mm-hmm. And you just have to know how they're different. And even on the book, you know, I tell people, you don't have to buy the book. The secret to getting orchids to rebloom is right on the back of the book. And there's three things you need to have. First, you have to know what kind of orchid you have. Then from that, you can find out what its native habitat is like. And if you reproduce the native habitat for your orchid, it is guaranteed to rebloom because that's the way nature works.
I was going to say, that's one of the keys that you would deal with at the botanical garden and the zoo and the wild animal park, I'm sure the same way, is you're trying to reproduce locally what their native habitat is.
Right.
And once you get that down, then
you're
not only
the
plants are not only going to grow, but they're going to thrive and they are going to reproduce like they do in the wild.
Which is why we could not, people would always ask us, can you grow those really cool blue poppies at the botanic garden? No, because they grow at 10,000 feet in the Himalayas and we don't have the ability to recreate those conditions.
I was talking about in one of the previous shows, the Tillandsia imperialis. Mm-hmm. Beautiful plant. It'll grow and flower down here, but it won't live down here because we're way below 10,000 feet and they need that high cold air. Mm-hmm. And it's really surprising to see a plant like that that grows in that type of condition because you wouldn't think so. It looks like a tropical plant, mm-hmm. but it's not.
Yeah.
So, as far as orchids are concerned, what would you say are the, if somebody was going to start out and they want something that's going to be easy to grow and rebloom on a pretty regular basis, what do you think your top few are?
Right. For most people, when they're talking about their orchids, they're often thinking of something as a house plant. Now, not everybody, and there are many orchids you could definitely keep outside, but if you're thinking about having an orchid as a house plant, the Phalaenopsis orchid is the way to go. Mm-hmm. For various reasons, just because one flower could last 4 or 5 months. The other thing is the light level it requires is, you know, anybody's got a spot in their home for that. And the temperature requirements for it is a lot like the interior of a home. And often when I, do these gardening classes, I'm talking about to people that the goal of gardening for anything that you do, like, you know, you've heard these quantum physicists that want to come up with that one equation that solves everything in the whole universe.
The unified theory.
Yeah, right. So I was thinking, well, would there be something like that for gardening? And then years ago, I thought, well, there is. And it's the following statement, like the goal of gardening for anything that you do is simply to reproduce the native habitat for your plant to get the desired growth habit. And it turns out that the interior of your home is a lot like the native habitat of a Phalaenopsis orchid. You know, like lower indirect light, a low level, low elevation in, you know, Southeast Asia, which how we keep our homes. Room temperature mm-hmm. is pretty good for a Phalaenopsis orchid. Another orchid that is great as a house plant that does, you know, very reliably reblooms, you have some here right now, are the Paphiopedilums, the lady slipper mm-hmm. orchids. They like a little cooler, but in terms of like an easy to rebloom houseplant orchid, those are excellent. And you have some nice ones in right now with the super dark burgundy flowers.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite orchid families are the Paphiopedilums, especially the species orchids. Mm-hmm. And that they are absolutely spectacular.
They catch your eyes when you walk in.
Yeah.
Zygopetalums are one of my favorite indoor orchids too. I get them to bloom 2 and 3 times a year.
Yeah.
And they're super fragrant.
Incredibly
gorgeous plants.
Yeah. That is a really nice one. But you might speak to this. One of the theories that I had seen too for getting Phalaenopsis to rebloom. I've talked to people that have had trouble getting them to rebloom, but one of the tips that I saw a while back that seems to work is they like a cold shock. And not a, they don't like to freeze, but they like to have a temperature drop. Whereas if you're growing it inside and it's out of bloom and you want to try to kickstart it, move it outside onto your patio for about a week. Same kind of light conditions and everything. You don't want to sunburn it or anything like that. But that temperature drop where it drops down into the 60s at night for a little while, and then you bring it back into the warm temperature again, can sometimes kickstart them into flowering. Have you come across that at all?
Yeah, definitely. I think that's something I even say in the book that, you know, I haven't traveled all over the world, but as far as I can see, it's anywhere on the planet cooler at night than during the day.
Yes. Yeah, that's a given.
Do you agree with that?
Okay. Yeah. It's that sun, right? It's the sun that does that?
Well, yeah, that's that bright thing in the sky.
Okay, got it.
Yeah,
right. All right.
So, but yeah, for any plant, that's important. For some plants more than others. And that's why it's really difficult to, say, get a Cymbidium orchid to rebloom as a house plant. There's just simply not enough light, and it thinks it's summer all the time, so it grows leaves. But yeah, for any orchid, it's good to have a drop in temperature of 10 to 15 degrees at night. And for a lot of people, just having it near a window that's open is sufficient. But if that's not the case, like what I found for people to have their Phalaenopsis orchids outside, and for many parts of San Diego County, it's too cold to have Phalaenopsis orchids outdoors all year long. But if you do have them outdoors, as long as you can, they almost always initiate spikes in October, November, and early December. Like, that's very reliable. But you're right. If you find it has not rebloomed, first of all, it may have nothing to do with the temperature. There's a lot of other reasons orchids, you know, don't rebloom. Yeah. And that's one of the chapters in the book, is the top five reasons that orchids fail to rebloom. And temperature is one of them. So if you're one of those people, you work a lot in the winter, you come home at the end of work and you turn your heater up, that might confuse your Phalaenopsis orchid.
I could see that. Yeah. You know, one other trick with Phalaenopsis that a lot of people don't realize is once the flowers fade, if you go back to the nodule where the last flower was on that stem, if the stem hasn't turned brown and faded, you can cut it back to that point. And a lot of times, more often than not, they will branch and send out another flower spike off the original flower spike.
Right.
And rebloom that way. Then you don't have to wait for the whole cycle to repeat from the base of the plant and move its way up. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. Our special guest, Chuck McClung, is with us, and we've been talking about how to rebloom orchids. We'll be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson along with George Allman and John Clements, and our special guest, Chuck McClung, local botanist, horticulturalist, and author. And we've been talking to Chuck about his first book on how orchids rebloom. And you had mentioned Cymbidiums, and Cymbidiums is probably one of the first orchids that I remember growing up with. And they're not as popular as they used to be about 30 or 40 years ago, but still a very popular plant, very easy to grow, grows outside and just about all over San Diego, and pretty bulletproof. Couple of things that I've learned over the years, some of it was from Byron Gear, who was a longtime employee of
ours. His name came up last week, I think, or the week before.
He's come up in the past. Yeah. But that was one of the first orchids that he started growing, was Cymbidium orchids, way back, probably before I was born.
He was big into Paphiopedilums,
and too. Paphiopedilums, too. But a couple of things that I've learned with Cymbidium orchids, they're a terrestrial orchid, for the most part. When you're growing them, if you grow them in a low light situation, they'll get beautiful, long, darker green foliage on them, but they don't bloom as well in that stage. You want them, their ideal foliage is going to be a little bit shorter and a little bit lighter green where they're getting more sunlight. As a matter of fact, we used to grow them under, I think ideally was about 55% shade is what we would grow them under. Mm-hmm. And then there was the trick to switching the fertilizers on them to get them to not only grow, but to rebloom. And we're going to talk a little bit about that.
Yeah.
And you had a very good, very simple key as far as orchid growing is concerned on what to feed and when.
Yeah. I mean, it's a lot of it, like in any of the classes I do, it says you got to know your plant. One of the things is to know something about the growth habit of your plant. Like, what does it do and what does it, when does it do it? So, you know, like in San Diego, there's some plants that lose their leaves in the summer. Some plants lose their leaves in the winter. For your Cymbidium orchid, you figure it's growing leaves in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
And that's your time to water. It's going to be very difficult to overwater a Cymbidium in the middle of summer. And then as those leaves grow, the pseudobulb forms, the plant gets ready to bloom over the winter months. Now, when it blooms depends on the hybrid and the parentage and all that. So I find that the most common reason that like a lot of Cymbidiums do not rebloom is they're not watered enough in the summer. People hear, oh, it's an orchid. It doesn't like as much water. Well, Cymbidiums are different because, again, they, as Ken said, they're terrestrial or semi-terrestrial. They don't live in trees. They live in loose leaf litter on the ground. So the roots need a little more moisture than an epiphytic orchid, yet they also require a lot of air. So that, like, a lot of times people come in and say, oh, I need some bark for my Cymbidium. Well, hold on a minute. Not bark. Mm-hmm. Usually like a mixture of fine bark and compost, or these days the coconut chips are being used to help repot them. So, you know, if you want to fertilize your orchid, that's great. That will definitely help. It's not required just because a lot of orchids come from nutrient poor environments. Like many cacti, you don't have to fertilize them to get them to bloom. It might help to bloom, have a higher bud count or something like that. But for your Cymbidium, you figure you want to give some kind of nitrogen fertilizer in the summer when it's growing those leaves. And then once those leaves have finished and the pseudobulb forms, it's going to be ready to bloom. And then you can switch over to a blooming fertilizer that's maybe higher in the middle number of the phosphorus. And just make sure with any fertilizer you're using that it is one for orchids and it has an instruction for orchids, because you always mix it up way more dilute than you would say like a other liquid feed, like a Miracle-Gro or something like mm-hmm. that. It's always going to be mixed up at a lower ratio. Yeah.
Yeah. The one that we used to recommend all the time before it, I think it was before Scott's got a hold of it and then wiped out the brand, was Peter's orchid food. And they, right. and it was, and we would recommend it. It was a 30-10-10 and I think a 5-30-30. And we, you would switch back and forth between those. Now it's Grow More is the, the one that we typically use. And it there again, the growth formula is a 30-10-10 and the blooming formula is a 5-30-30 to get them to grow and rebloom. You know, it's, you talk about the bark and the compost. I can't tell you how many thousands of cubic feet of Cymbidium planting mix I mixed up back in the day. We used to, we used to make it ourselves, and it was simple. It was fine orchid bark, which is a fir bark, and it was 1/8 to 1/4 inch orchid bark and redwood compost. Mm-hmm. And it was a specific redwood compost that we would get from Butler's mm-hmm. Mill.
I'm not wrong.
It was almost like redwood shavings rather than compost, and it was nitrilized. Mm-hmm. Sometimes in the summertime, you'd rip those bags open, and the ammonia smell would almost knock you out. But that's all it was. It was orchid bark and redwood compost, and they absolutely loved it.
Your dad, when he taught the Cymbidium classes here, he just used coconut core.
Yeah. He switched over to that.
And well, when he moved. He brought all the orchids into the nursery and I repotted them into coconut fiber and to see what they do. And we didn't even fertilize them that year, and a lot of them just rebloomed fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, the coconut fiber, the commercial grower switched over about maybe 15 to 20 years ago because it lasts longer than bark. And it provides the airy, moist mixture that those Cymbidium roots love.
Yeah.
And it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, stuff. Coconut core has been kind of a game changer in that regard.
You got to make sure you get the chunky coconut fiber, not the stuff that looks like peat
moss.
Not the ground up stuff.
I used to put oak leaf mold in my Cymbidium mix back in the day too, but you can't get oak leaf mold anymore.
Well, you know, it's funny that our supplier for oak leaf mold for years and years was Kellogg's. And they had a couple of guys that had a couple of old vans, and they would go out somewhere in the hills here in Southern California, and there were property owners that had property with oak trees on them, and they would just go out and they would fill those vans with oak leaf mold and bring it back, and Kellogg's would bag it up, and then that all disappeared. I haven't seen oak leaf mold.
Oh, we did have some.
We had some about 2 years ago. About, maybe it was the last time I've seen it here.
For it, but it wasn't. But by that time, it had fallen so out of favor just because it hadn't been used for so long. People didn't know what it was. But yeah, oak leaf mold was a good additive for it at one time. You know, another interesting thing about orchids that that people don't realize, and actually I guess it's probably true with just about any orchid that forms a pseudo bulb, is when they get big, you can divide them up and you can take the individual back bulbs, the bulbs that have already flowered, replant them, grow them into a new plant. It's not like planting a daffodil bulb or anything like that, but those pseudo bulbs will typically regrow into new plants, and you can make more plants.
So a way
from
to
multiply
or to propagate.
Yeah.
Because they call them pseudo bulbs because they're not real bulbs. Like the normal term bulb refers to a storage organ for a plant that allows it to be dormant during a certain part of the year, and so those true bulbs are storing things like nutrients and carbohydrates and stuff like that. Whereas a pseudo bulb in an orchid is mainly storing water.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. I was not aware of that.
Yeah, and that's to provide...
That's why you bought the botanist in.
Yeah, and hence my lack of a botany degree. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So a lot of... For orchids, those pseudobulbs are providing water to the active growing part of the plant when, say, it just doesn't happen to be raining as frequently as the plant normally gets it. And so it's common for the oldest pseudobulbs to eventually just die off. And they, you know, that's okay.
Mm-hmm.
It might be something's wrong, but just because one of the older pseudobulbs looks dry and dead doesn't mean anything's wrong with the plant. But yeah, you can definitely, in ideal conditions, those pseudobulbs will grow a whole new plant. Because at the base of the pseudobulb, like on a dahlia tuber, there's a little eye from where the new shoot will come out. Now, it's said that, let's say you have a large cymbidium in a pot. You know, if you break it up into individual pseudobulbs, well, each of those pseudobulbs may take a few years to rebloom.
Yes.
But generally, it's suggested if you're going to divide any orchid or a cymbidium, is that you would divide it in so that you have five pseudobulbs per division, and that helps to kind of guarantee the plant will just take off and still bloom again that next year.
I remember when we were doing a lot of cymbidium orchid repotting. That was a service that we used to do. We would try to keep about between three and five pseudobulbs per division, with at least one new growth coming off of the clump of pseudobulbs. And that way they would regrow and bloom much faster. The other thing that I remember that we used to do when we were repotting cymbidiums is they like to have really tight root systems on them, and we would jam the planting medium. We had a cutoff broom handle. We would pack that stuff so tight, and that was how you could tell. How we would tell if it was repotted properly is after you repotted it, you could pick the plant. If you could pick the plant up by the foliage and the pot would come up with it, that was where you wanted to be. We used to do a lot of cymbidium repotting back in the day. What are some of the other popular orchids that you don't see all that frequently in the markets these days? Like you said, everybody sees the Phalaenopsis. Everybody sees the cymbidium orchids for the most part. Yeah, one that has kind of disappeared, you don't see as frequently, are cattleyas.
That's what I was going to mention.
Yeah.
Yeah, the big reason for that is it's not a very retail savvy plant, because one flower might only last a couple weeks.
Yeah.
So to the retailer, you think, well, do I bring in those cattleyas or not? Oh boy, what if they don't sell? Then you're stuck with them. But the cattleyas, to me, are one of the best orchids to grow in trees, because they have those thick leaves, thick pseudobulbs. They can handle that. That if, you know, you don't have everything exactly right, a lot of my clients, it's the cattleyas that we're putting in the trees. And they do very well that way. But yeah, there are so many different hybrids and cultivars of cattleyas and what they call the cattleya alliance. Like I think last week it came up in your program, you were talking about Brassivolas. Well, that's a cattleya relative. So you'll see an orchid called a BC, like a Brasso cattleya, or a BLC is a Brasso Lelio cattleya. And all of those are tremendous plants, very showy flowers. Some are fragrant. And some of them, you know, like with the Oncidium alliance, we try to get a spring bloomer and a fall bloomer and hybridize them. And you get something that blooms twice a year. But the cattleyas are definitely one that you don't see as much. You see them at orchid shows, but in a retail setting, it's not sometimes the easiest, because they just don't bloom for very long.
Yeah. So. Talking about holding flowers, that's one thing I wanted to mention about cymbidiums. You'd mentioned they don't make excellent houseplants unless you want to grow them for the foliage, and you're not really going to get much flowers. But people they'll bloom them out. They'll get them to bloom outside, and then they'll move them in the house. And when you move them in the house, the flowers only last about maybe a week to 10 days, 2 weeks at the most. Right. But if you leave them outside and you keep the slugs and snails off of them, because they are a magnet for slugs and snails,
yeah, they are.
Those flowers will last for a very, very long time.
Well, it's like in a florist shop, you know, they keep the flowers lasting longer in the cooler. So any plant will bloom longer if you can keep it at the cool end of its temperature tolerance spectrum. So, you know, and that's the thing, when cymbidiums are blooming, most people have their heater on. You bring it inside, the air's drier, and they don't bloom for as long, or especially when people bring them inside and water them at the same rate, the flowers could just all fall off.
Yeah.
So yeah, any plant you can have outside as long as you can is always going to be better.
Yeah. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ, and our special guest, Chuck McClung. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to be back with more right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements, and our special guest, Chuck McClung. And we've been talking about orchids and how you can grow orchids and how you can get them, how you can successfully grow them and get them to rebloom in your yard or in your home. We had finished up talking about cymbidium orchids, and we had mentioned that cymbidium orchids are either terrestrial or semi-terrestrial. And we had talked about a little bit about cattleyas and some of the other related orchids in that family, in that alliance, the Brassivolas and Lelias. And they're epiphytic, meaning that they grow on trees. And we've talked about that in the past. Epiphytes are different than parasites in that they don't pull nutrients from the actual host plant. The host plant is basically there for support.
Right.
But there are a number of different orchids that you can grow outside in your garden epiphytically. Cattleyas, Lelias, Brassivolas. Lelias are one that you don't see as much anymore, but pretty easy to grow.
Oh yeah, very easy to grow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm going to go back to when he said you're putting cattleyas in trees.
Right.
How does that work? What are the requirements? How does one water those? What's the light requirement and temperature more so, I guess, would be the big question for me.
Yeah, so a lot of it comes down to what I think we already touched on, is you're just trying to reproduce the native habitat of your plant. So for most people in San Diego County, you can't grow a Phalaenopsis in a tree all year long. Like, it's just too cold in the winter and it'll die. Mm-hmm. I have clients in Coronado, and we have many Phalaenopsis that live through the winter, but every once in a while, there'll be a winter where half of them die. It's just too cold. Mm-hmm. So you know, and then say we're here in Poway, there's going to be like pansy orchids. That's Walter's one of his favorite. You're not growing those in trees in Poway. It's just too hot, you know, so you just have to get the right orchid for your environment. And that's why I like the cattleyas, because they can handle this wide range in temperatures. They can handle temperatures down in the low 40s. They can handle temperatures in the high 80s. So cattleyas make one of those great plants to use as an epiphyte in a tree. The other one is the Oncidium Alliance, because there's so many different kinds and they work great in trees. But again, some orchids, you can't have them in full sun. They have to be in the interior of the tree or on the trunk of the tree, so they're getting filtered light. But a lot of it's just finding that old expression, right plant, right place. So if you're going to have an orchid and you want to mount it in a tree, if you've ever been here to the nursery to see the classes on the staghorns, what you often see is you have like a board, you put moss and put the staghorn on top of it. The orchid, it's a little different. We want the roots right on the tree itself. So often we get the orchid, we totally take it out of its pot, remove the potting media so it's bare root, and then put it on the tree. I would often use fishing line, and then we pack moss on top of the roots so that the roots are on the tree. Then the trick is, look, how do you water that? Well, some people that have an irrigation system will just tap into one of the lines and put a micro tube with a sprayer right on the moss around it. That works well. The people say, oh, I'll just water it by hand. I'm like, yeah. Maybe you want to avoid that.
But at least the first 2 weeks they'll get to it, right?
Yeah. Right. And then they'll forget and it won't do so well. But yeah, I mean, even, okay, they're living in trees. They're not in pots. So they are going to need water. So that's just something you have to make sure happens. And again, depending on what the plant is, you have to water accordingly. If you have certain orchids in trees, they might need water 3 times a week in the middle of summer. In the winter, you probably don't water them at all as long as it's raining. So a lot of it just depends on the plant and where you live in the county.
And the root system on the epiphytic
on the epiphytic orchids. That's what actually attaches to the tree.
Yeah,
they will stick
definitely
to it.
The roots stick to the tree.
And during the break, we were talking about the roots specifically of orchids, in that they're different than a lot of plant roots, in that their root itself is actually encased in a spongy material.
Right.
So what you see, even though the root is there, is not necessarily the root of the plant.
Correct. Yeah. There's a spongy tissue called velamen that surrounds the orchid root. And there are a group of other plants, I can't think of the genus, that actually have velamen on their roots. They're plants that have aerial roots, I think in like Central or South America. But orchids are different. They have this velamen tissue that covers the root. And what this tissue does is it rapidly absorbs small amounts of water out of the air and then dries out. And so, like, I find the most common reason that orchids die is that people water them too much. Now, first of all, as an aside, I'll say in my new book, there's a chapter called Death by Overwatering. And what I assert is that it's absolutely impossible to overwater a plant. And maybe we'll come back to that. But the idea is that if the velamen stays wet all the time, the velamen rots, then the root rots and the plant dies. So the roots absorb small amounts of moisture out of the air due to that velamen being present. And no velamen, the plant's not going to be happy.
You know, it's funny, you talk about the velamen. I remember whether it was Phalaenopsis or usually on Cymbidiums, when you take them out and the root systems, the roots that have died,
right,
that are no longer functioning, you'll have a really fibrous thread and then just the rotted casing of the root on the outside of it, and that's where the root has died. The velamen is decomposed, and you just have the dead root left inside of it. So you can see that pretty frequently.
Yeah, and that's common, because if we grow orchids in pots, the oldest roots associated with the oldest growths and oldest pseudobulbs, those roots will die along with the pseudobulb as it dies out. And so when we're repotting orchids, we have to repot them every few years, because the potting media that we're using is not decomposed. It's not soil like we use for carrots and cucumbers. Mm-hmm. So it has to be refreshed so that it's this airy, moisture-retaining potting media that it was designed to be. Because the more the potting media breaks down, it becomes like soil and doesn't provide the air that the roots need. And so that's what's going on when you take the Cymbidium out of the pot. That's why it has to be repotted. If you don't, all the roots are going to rot because the potting media is breaking down.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. One of the orchid families that you talked about was Oncidiums, which I think is a fascinating family, because the variety is
huge.
Absolutely huge. And you have everything from, I think the biggest, the largest Oncidium that I can think of off the top of my head is Oncidium papilio, which has has a large flat pseudobulb to it, but the foliage is massive on top of that, all the way down to one that used to be extremely popular about 30 years ago. We could not keep them in stock. Equiton Oncidiums. Probably small, little teeny ones.
People don't grow those anymore.
Our supplier used to be right near the corner of Poway Road and Espola Road. And she had one whole side of her house. That's all she grew, was Equiton Oncidiums. And she would grow them on little sections of grapewood burl, mm-hmm, about 4 or 5 inches long. And when they were in bloom, we'd make a special trip up here from San Diego just to buy those things. And we would bring them down to San Diego. We could not keep them in stock.
And Hardy and Charlie Fouquet used to raise a lot of those.
Oh, did they used to?
Yeah.
But you just don't see them anymore.
Yeah, I don't even think I see them much at the orchid shows in Balboa, mm-hmm, Park. But that genus, like that group of Equiton Oncidiums, is now called, I think, Tulumnia.
Oh, really?
It's a separate genus.
Yeah, okay.
And that is, like, I think we talked about that. It's like the Phalaenopsis, in that it will rebloom several times on the same spike. Mm-hmm. Those little spikes will rebloom over and over, like a Phalaenopsis. But yeah, it's so many different colors.
Mm-hmm.
The little teeny flowers with markings. But yeah, I mean, I haven't seen one of those in years.
Yeah, they look like little kaleidoscopes.
They're really interesting.
It's a when you can find them, it is a really neat plant.
Really
and
neat plant.
And you know, on the opposite end of it too, the Oncidium papilio, one of the most interesting flowers in an epiphytic orchid that I think there is. They huge spikes, and the flowers themselves are quite are quite large. Oh, you're sporting one yourself? really neat flower. The flowers are... It's been a long time since I've seen one.
Schomburgkia tibicinus. That's one. It's like an 8-foot long spike. I used to put those in Bill Walton's backyard over by the zoo.
But yeah, the Oncidium's it's a neat flower. The one, I don't remember which one it is, but the one that you usually see now is the relatively common one. Huge sprays of flowers, little flowers about this, between the size of a nickel and a quarter, solid yellow.
Oncidium sphesolatum, maybe?
Well, it just depends on where you go. But what I don't understand, why somebody doesn't contract somebody to grow the Oncidium called Sherry Baby. And it's got a flower that's burgundy, about the size of a quarter, with a little bit of white markings in it. But it is extremely fragrant, and it's a complex hybrid that will bloom 2 or 3 times a year. It's one of the easiest Oncidiums or any orchid to get to rebloom, but they are so incredibly fragrant. Like, why somebody doesn't contract a grower just to grow these, and you can sell like 20 a week, put them right at the register, and the fragrance is like vanilla chocolate.
They raise them in Hawaii, and Kathy up at Pacific Orchids in Leucadia has them all the time.
Yeah, they're Leucadia, that place has them a lot. Right. Yeah, and they're easy to find in an orchid show.
We should have Kathy on the show too.
Yeah. That would be a good one. Is that the one that people would refer to as a chocolate?
We've carried it.
It has a very sweet, almost chocolatey smell.
Yeah, and it's the power of suggestion. It's a vanilla fragrance one. When people see the color, it's chocolate. If you put a sign that says chocolate, people will think it smells like chocolate. If you say vanilla, it smells like vanilla.
That's one that I have not seen that one in a long time. But yeah, you're right. Yeah. That is a...
It's a great one.
The other one is
Oncidium Twinkle. And I think, if I remember right, one of the parents of Oncidium Twinkle is one of the parents of Sherry Baby. But it's a fall-only blooming orchid with sprays of little teeny flowers, like hundreds of them. They're extremely fragrant, like a honey vanilla fragrance. That I don't see that one as much either at a retail level. But Oncidium Twinkle, that was a pretty neat plant.
That's another interesting one. You know, one of my favorite families of orchids, closely related to Phalaenopsis, but not anywhere near as easy to grow over here, are Vandas.
Oh yeah,
I've always loved Vandas. I think they're absolutely spectacular. And I remember when we were importing stuff, we would bring them over from Thailand, and they would come over in a wooden crate teak basket. With absolutely no potting media.
No potting media.
And then we would get them over here and we would kill them. they are not easy to grow in our climate, unfortunately.
Yeah, I mean, a Vanda, you figure its native habitat, as far as sort of how we're familiar in this country, would be Florida, where it's like warm and humid all the time.
All the time.
I have a client, Coronado. He's great with Vandas, but he's got this enclosed backyard that keeps the humidity. He's got drippers going to it. And if you go to an orchid show in Balboa Park, you'll see Vanda orchids with 6-foot long roots and no potting media.
Yeah.
You try to bring that home as a houseplant, it'll be dead in 2 months.
It's not going to make it. Yeah. You're listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. I'm Ken Anderson, along with George Allman and John Clements, and our special guest, Chuck McClung. And we've been talking about orchids, and we've got a lot more to talk about. So stay tuned. We'll be back with more Garden Talk right after this.
There's more Garden Talk on the way. Welcome back to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery. Here's your hosts, Ken Anderson, George Allman, and John Clements.
And we're back with more Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ. And we have our special guest, Chuck McClung. We've been talking orchids and getting them to rebloom. You know, it's interesting you talk about your client over in Coronado who has the Vandas. The last time we were back in Florida, which this was a year ago, last February, and then I went down to Palm Beach, and we were walking around in Palm Beach in some of the residential areas down there. There were a number of houses where they had taken and strapped Phalaenopsis to the palm tree trunks in their in their front yard, and hundreds of them. Yeah. I mean, and just solid cascades of flowers coming off of them. And blooming and growing like crazy. But then again, it's always warm and humid in Palm Beach, and it's a perfect environment for them.
Yeah.
So like,
unlike dry Poway.
unlike dry Poway. Right, and you know, Poway. And talking about pandas, there was an orchid nursery as you would go out Valley Center Road, and it was just past a little bit past Colgrade Road, the intersection of Colgrade Road, and it was on the right hand side. It was, you're driving along, and then there was a greenhouse that was just in the middle of nowhere. And I remember stopped in there a couple of times, and they had vandas. They grew vandas there. They had tons of them. But there again, it's as beautiful as they are. That's a tricky one to grow in San Diego. I've never been successful with it, unfortunately. But it is one of my favorite plants.
And growing anything, when we say something is tricky, what that means is that plant's native habitat doesn't match the one you're in.
Right.
It's pretty simple.
Well, I just said dry Poway, and so that means that we're going to water our plants a lot more. But you, Chuck, in your strawberry book, you mentioned death by overwatering.
Right.
And I was curious because we sell orchids that have sphagnum moss on it. And you said a lot of people kill their orchids because they overwater them, give them too much love.
Right.
What's your thought on that, on having that moss on it?
Right. So, you know, my goal or my whole life mission is to solve people's gardening dilemmas. And my whole thing is to get people to give them information so it goes in their head and translate stays into some positive action in their hands. And so I find different ways and sometimes silly ways to explain things to try to drive the point home. So when it comes to watering, a lot of people are concerned about overwatering a plant. And so I have this new kind of dialogue I developed where I'll go, well, what do you mean overwater a plant? I mean, water's good. How could you possibly overwater a plant? They go, well, it would just die. It's like, well, why would it die if the plant's 90%, 95% water? And they go, well, the roots would rot. I said, but why would the roots rot if water's good? And eventually, after this dialogue going on and on, eventually somebody will say, well, the roots will suffocate. Okay, there we go. That's the problem, is that the roots suffocate. And the trick is like, it's not the water that's the problem. It's the water displacing air that creates an issue for the plant roots. So like cacti and succulents, people are more familiar with, we say, oh, they have to have a potting media that drains. Well, it's not because the water, it's not for the water. It's so the roots get the air they require. Or like you say, you sell a lot of Hoyas. We'll say, well, a Hoya likes a small pot. Well, who are we to say whether plants like pots at all? But, you know, Hoyas like small pots, in quotes, because their roots have a high demand for air. So similarly, you mentioned like these Phalaenopsis orchids, or orchids that come in with moss as a top dressing. So if that moss is impeding air getting to the roots, you're going to have a problem. So there's some people that can water just right and they have a feel for it. They leave the orchid in the cachet pot and it does okay. But for most people, that's not going to work. You know, you want to take it out of the cachet pot. If there's decorative moss around the top, you may or may want to remove that. But the whole idea is that you cannot overwater a plant. And my term is under-airing. You can under-air the roots of a plant. And I like to drive the point home and I'll say, well, if I ask you to sit at the bottom of your swimming pool, I think you'd agree you won't die from overwatering. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea is that if I can impress into people's mind that the roots have a requirement for air, yes, they have a requirement for water, but potting media is a lot like the carburetor. It's balancing something and air. And so any potting media that you buy for a plant, one of its functions is to provide the proper balance of water and air for the plant, which that's designed. And so like we mentioned with cymbidiums and using the coconut fiber, you use the chunky stuff. So there's lots of air. If you use the stuff that's shredded in a peat moss, not enough air and the roots will rot from under airing, not over water.
Well, that's,
I like that.
Yeah. With heavy clay soils, there's not a lot of air. The right particles are so fine, there's right no airspace for them to grow in. And I had read one time that plants don't grow in soil. They grow in the space that the soil provides.
That's from Mr. Seamus from Dr. Earth. He's the guy that said that. When he came to my nursery years ago, he said he'd give a free box of fertilizer to anybody that could say where do roots grow. And I said, well, it depends how you look at it. They don't actually grow in the soil at all. I said, give that man a free box of fertilizer. But yeah, he started that as his marketing for his Dr. Earth fertilizers. But yeah, roots don't actually grow in soil. They grow in the air spaces. But a soil scientist would say, well, the air spaces are part of the soil matrix.
Yes.
You have to consider it as one whole thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Your second book that you put out is Strawberries Are Not a Fruit.
Yes.
Did you want to elaborate on that a little
Do you want to contest that point?
I think it's going to take
another whole show because it's a lot of information.
We could get started. We can tease the next show with that.
Yeah. So a couple of years ago, I thought, you know, I just had that itch to write again because I'd done a lot of writing in the past. And I thought, well, what could I write about? And I thought, well, what if I just wrote a bunch of short essays on the things that I say the most, mainly because that'd be an easy book to crank out, you know? And a lot of that new book, A Strawberry is Not a Fruit, it's the subtitle is And Other Lesser Known Perspectives from the World of Plants. So it's a bunch of little short chapters on different ways of looking at plants. One of which chapter we already mentioned called Death by Overwatering. And when I was doing the book, I just could not figure out a title. I said, what am I going to call it? I mean, I know what the subtitle is and other lesser known perspectives from the world of plants. So I thought, why don't I just pick the chapter with the catchiest title and then just call the book that and say, and other blah, 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 blah. So the strawberry not being a fruit seems like the thing that really catches people. So should we explain that?
Yes,
oh, please. Great. Yeah.
So I think that to understand that it's easier for people to think about a related fruit, that being a raspberry. So many people have picked raspberries or see raspberries where you pick a raspberry and it's got this cavity in it. And what's left on the plant is a post. You pull the raspberry off the plant and there's a post and a hole in the raspberry. So that post that's left on the plant is called the receptacle, where all the flower parts join together on the plant. And the raspberry itself is an aggregate fruit. Each of those little balls in a raspberry is one fruit. So if you could picture then that little post that's left on the plant after you pick the raspberry, if you imagine that swelling up like a balloon, and if you picture the little balls on the raspberry fruit shrinking down into little dots and then put the two back together, you get a strawberry, which is swollen receptacle tissue with fruits dotted on the outside.
Okay.
So a strawberry is not really a fruit. It's a collection of fruits. So the when you see, oh, well, and you say, well, a fruit is a covering of a seed that grows from part of the flower. So if a fruit is a covering of seed, why are the seeds of the strawberry on the outside? Well, it means we're using the terms wrong. Those aren't seeds. Those are the fruits. And the strawberry is swollen receptacle tissue. So that's
clear
what that
as
means.
Mud. Everyone understands.
Well, so that's what we put a picture in the book.
Yeah. It's the technical term, if I recall botany, a drup.
Well, there are many types of fruit names. Like I think I would call a raspberry or a strawberry an aggregate fruit because it's a collection of fruits. Like a pom is what we call an apple, a peepo is a cucumber. There's all different like botanical terms for types of fruits.
Right,
but
right.
The one thing is like, don't get too wrapped up in the words, you know, because the words are always less than that which they describe. Like the word red isn't red. You can't get wet from the word water. You know, you don't go to a restaurant, order a menu and eat the menu.
So along that line, I would imagine that mulberries would be a type of aggregate fruit.
Yeah, I think you'd call the mulberry an aggregate fruit, right?
Yeah. And so pretty much any of the cane berries would fall into that. And I had read that somewhere about raspberries. Very interesting. What other tidbits from Strawberry is Not a Fruit, do you?
Yeah, well, along those lines, so the book is kind of grouped into four sections. I had like many, many chapters and had to pare it down just for the sake of size. But the first thing is called Basic Gardening. There's a lot of little chapters on gardening, and there's a group on botany, kind of more of the technical aspects of plants. And then there's a section on edible plants, and that's where the Strawberry is Not a Fruit is. And in there, I like to bring this one up. So if a fruit is a covering of a seed that grows from part of the flower. I'm sure you're all familiar with sunflowers.
Mm-hmm.
You've probably all eaten sunflower seeds.
Mm-hmm.
So where's the fruit? I mean, if there's a flower and a seed, the fruit's in between somewhere. Where's the fruit? Well, it turns out for a sunflower, that again is a collection of fruits, and the sunflower seed with the shell on it is the fruit. Each little dot you see in the center of a sunflower is an individual flower.
Now, would that be true for all plants in the composite family?
Yes.
Family?
Yeah. Yeah. So like the Compositae or Asteraceae family in the strawberry book, there's a chapter called the top five familiar flowering plant families. Say that fast. And one of them is Asteraceae. And there's a chapter called Asterology, What is One Flower? Because like an aster, whether it be a dahlia, a marigold, sunflower, zinnias, anything with the word daisy is actually many, many flowers mimicking one flower.
Hence the term composite.
Composite, yeah. Meaning put together. Right. So another chapter along those lines, right after the strawberry chapter, it says fig isn't a fruit either. So I like going to nurseries, and I've never been to, and I'll test an employee. I see a ficus, and I go, what color is the flower on this ficus here? And see what they say, you know. But the whole idea is that a fig is basically a sunflower inside out.
Yes.
So all the flowers and fruits for a fig are inside the fig itself. And so you never see the flower. It's in there. And that hole that's in the bottom of the fig is to allow the fig wasp symbiont to go in there and pollinate all the flowers and do their mating and whatever. So
yeah, yeah. And that was one of the things that we had talked about some time ago on the show was technically figs may not be vegan because they have the dead bodies of the insects that pollinate them still inside of them.
Right. Well, I would say nothing's truly vegan because you can't separate a plant from the soil that it grows in. And there's always dead animals in the soil.
Well, there you go.
So you get too much into words, you get little tangles because the words don't quite line up. Yep. Anyway.
Very good.
And real quick, Ken, if I could, before you have a website.
Yeah.
So, and what is that?
Yes.
My website is the title of the orchid book, which is cleverly howorchidsrebloom.com. And on there, it lists like the different things that I do, or right now, a lot of gardening clubs are contacting me because they're doing their programs. And October 8th, I'll be the guest speaker for the Poway Valley Garden Club. It'll be a book signing event just on the Strawberries Not a Fruit book.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah. Well, hopefully folks will come out and see that.
And he's teaching here in August.
Oh,
yeah.
Excellent.
August 9th.
August 9th. Yeah. Okay. So come out and see Chuck. You've been listening to Garden Talk here on KCBQ and KPRZ and our special guest, Chuck McClung. Chuck, I hope you'll come back and visit us again sometime.
Yeah, thanks. Like it. Great.
Great time. Have a great weekend, everybody. We'll be back with another hour of Garden Talk next week.
Thank you for listening to Garden Talk by Walter Anderson Nursery, independent and family-owned since 1928. For more information about plants, products, expert advice, news, classes, podcasts, and more, visit walteranderson.com.